playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning and you're very welcome to Ho 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 and Jingle Bells Playback. We are almost there, baubles and tinsel at the ready. And radio-wise, it's been a mix of festive food, books, some highs and lows of the year, and last-minute gifts for the mithered among us. But, as Colm O'Regan pointed out in his Wednesday column for Drive Time, some people are just a little too organised for their own good.
It might seem a bit late for a Christmas gift guide, but this diary is not aimed at you who are all finished buying and smug and doing things like focusing on buying experiences rather than buying stuff. You probably had coherent colour-coded flashcards when you were studying for the Leaving Cert. Maybe had a meal with your family the night before English Paper 2 instead of cramming. Perverts.
Hark the herald angels sing, sir. That was Colm O'Regan on Drive Time. Might you be referring to this man, pray tell?
Last night I made the cranberry sauce and the gravy. That's probably smug, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because that was Ray Darcy on Tuesday. Yes, last Tuesday. Sure, he's probably started the New Year detox already. But in fairness, it is a week when every dog and divil in the country is scanning the recipe books for fail-safe turkey recipes. Nobody wants a dry bird. Stuffing of every variety. Yum. And these receptacles of pure evil are served up.
In order to cut down the work on Christmas Day itself, yes. What I like to do is to pre-cook the Brussels sprouts the day before. Mm-hmm. But you can't do that just to the ordinary Brussels sprout. It won't work. They'll go kind of soggy. So what I do is I shred them, having prepared the Brussels sprouts, yeah. I shred them in my food processor.
The raw sprouts, yeah.
Yeah, raw sprouts. And so they're all very thinly sliced. I just check, you might see the odd little bit of
stalk. Or woody bits, yeah.
Just take that away. And then drop them into a pot of boiling salted water, but not too much boiling salted water. Cook them for about 10 minutes.
Okay.
And that should tenderise them. Drain off all the hot water and run cold water right through it to cool down completely.
To stop the cooking.
To stop the cooking. Yeah. And also that keeps the lovely green colour.
Oh, good idea. Yeah.
And then you can put into a plastic bag, as I have in my hand.
Yes.
It means it fits easily into the fridge.
Squeezes
you're not
in,
putting
yeah.
in bowls,
bowls
of water.
Yeah, very good.
And then on Christmas Day itself, you melt a lump of butter in a saucepan and toss in your prepared, cooked sprouts, cook them around, put a little bit of salt and pepper and serve them.
Or throw them straight into the bin. That was Brenda Costigan on the Beelzebub of Vegetables with Joe Duffy's seasonal top tips on Wednesday's Liveline. Now, books, reading and libraries were a theme that threaded throughout much of this week. And on Monday, Ryan Tuberty's Christmas came early when he got to talk to Aaron Sorkin, the writer of The Social Network, the new film Molly's Game and the television series The West Wing, among others. This is the show where foreign policy was decided by wisecracking, fast-talking, Gilbert and Sullivan-loving Democrats who stalked the halls of the White House, presided over by a wise Jed Bartlett, who gave very good speeches. Catnip for Ryan Tuberty. And Aaron Sorkin's introduction to cracking dialogue came via a play which features a blistering attack and counterattack by a warring husband and wife.
Let me ask you a little bit about yourself. From what I understand it, you're 9 years old, you're living in New York, you're dragged probably along to see who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, but you're intrigued and enthralled by the dialogue. And so that dialogue junkie, if you like, Aaron Sorkin is kind of born. But I really want to get to the library because that's where you got the recordings of Broadway plays. The library it has to be an essential part of any community. But in your life, it's part of your story.
That's right. You're absolutely right about that. My parents took me to see plays that I was way too young to understand, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf when I was 9. But I loved the sound of dialogue. It sounded like music to me. Mm. And I wanted to imitate that sound. My local library had a record albums, two album set, vinyl, of course, that had the original cast, the four actors in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, performing the whole thing. Yeah. So I would play all the parts in my bedroom. And there was a time I actually could recite that entire 3.5-hour play from memory, which must have made me the oddest little kid. My parents had to have been terribly concerned.
For a while.
But you're right. The local library played a, a big part in my life, and I hope that local libraries are still alive and healthy today. I suspect with the internet, they're less so.
And how does he view the rather left-leaning idealism of the West Wing in light of the current presidency?
It was a hopeful show, an optimistic show. Mm-hmm. It was romantic and idealistic, but it did show us, you know, what we could be from time to time. There are times today that I do wish the show was, you know, was on for an hour once a week, so we could watch a White House press conference, listen to a question, and just hear the sound of truth. No matter what the question was about, it could be about the most arcane tax issue, but just to hear C.J. Craig give an answer that makes sense. Like I said earlier, sometimes, you know, just when you see and hear simple decency, it can be very arresting.
Screenwriter Aaron Sorkin with the suitably enthralled Ryan Tuberty on Monday. On Tuesday, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Liz Meldon. She's the owner of the Rathgar Bookshop in Dublin. She may have to shut up shop next month after 26 years in business. And I think it's fair to say that she is sometimes less than impressed by the behaviour of some of her customers.
And would you come across people who come into you and they look and they'll browse whatever, but you get the sense that actually they're going to go off now and order that book online?
Absolutely. They'll even take a photograph. They'll ask advice about what books, you know, that, you know, I would suggest. And then they'll go, great, thank you very much. And I mean, also Kindles, even though they're saying that people aren't using Kindles anymore, they are using Kindles, without a doubt. I mean, I had one woman coming in to say that out of the 10 people in her book club, 8 of them had Kindles. That's a very high statistic. Mm-hmm. Another woman came in, a new customer, and looked around the shop, sat down, had a coffee, opened up her iPad, read her book on Kindle for an hour at least, and then came up to the counter, paid for her coffee and said, what a lovely bookshop, and walked out. Like, that for me would be like walking into a restaurant, ordering coffee, taking my egg sandwiches out of my handbag, sitting there and saying, great, I'll be back here for lunch.
Liz Meldon of the Rathgar Bookshop in Dublin in conversation with Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Later that afternoon, Liveline listeners voted for their favourite Irish book of the year for 2017.
And the top Irish book of 2017 is Book A, Atlas of the Irish Revolution by John Crowley, Donal O'Driscoll, Mike Murphy and John Borgonovo, who was actually on this programme recently talking about history. And it's published by the Cork University Press. As I say, 5K in weight, 1,000 pages, and it's 200 contributors, including, I didn't want to say it earlier on to put people off, including a chapter I wrote on the children killed and arising. But it's beautifully illustrated.
Liveline Book of the Year, and you in it, Joe. A mere coincidence. On Wednesday, it emerged that the central bank had found another 13,600 cases where banks had wrongly withheld tracker mortgages from their customers. Mary Wilson on Drive Time reminded us of the numbers and the timeline.
First, there were two cases where one bank had withheld tracker mortgage rates unfairly from customers. Then that bank revealed it had done the same to 1,400 others. As the central bank dug deeper, this time last year we heard that there were at least 8,200 cases involving all of the five main banks. 10 weeks ago, in October, we heard that around 13,000 cases had now been identified. By the end of October, the figure was over 21,000. This afternoon, the central bank revealed that the number of cases where Irish banks wrongly withheld tracker mortgages from their customers now stands at an extraordinary 33,700.
Mary Wilson crunching the numbers on Wednesday's Drive Time. And earlier that day, Sean O'Rourke spoke to Katrina Redmond, an Ulster Bank customer who is still waiting for a refund and redress. And her story put a human face to these numbers.
Since last year, and in an effort to make sure that we didn't go back into arrears, I took on two extra part-time jobs. So we're not struggling financially, but that means that I'm out of the home an awful lot. I work very, very long hours to make sure that the bills are paid and that we don't end up in financial difficulty. But the stress levels, as this has gone on through the year, have really, really increased. September was an incredibly difficult time for us when we thought that we were going to get redress into October. I've started to lose my hair. I've got particularly bad psoriasis, a reaction to stress at the moment. And it's not from financial struggles, but it's this concern, this overcharge that sits in our mortgage that faces me every single day when I check the bank account.
Yeah.
It's the stress of the arrears letters coming in the door from the bank. It's the stress of them not being able to answer me realistically when I phone them. As recently as Monday, no, you're not redressed yet. But that's not to say that it's not going to happen before the end of the year. It's incredibly frustrating and stressful.
Katrina Redmond with Sean on Wednesday. And back to Mary Wilson. She spoke to Pádraig Casán, the financial advisor who has campaigned on this issue for years. And she put this to him on the banks.
Have they been brought to heel? Have they been humbled? Or is that a word you'd ever use in this context? And what will be the penalties on them?
Well, one of the things I suppose I would like to see is that the culture within the banks becomes more customer-focused rather than profit-focused. I think a lot of the banks have had an inherited issue here in relation to how they dealt with their customers. I mean, you have to understand, customers are, when taking out a mortgage, it's probably the biggest financial transaction that are taking place. I have a lot of other issues that I have to resolve here. One, for example, all the banks have stated now that they don't advise anybody on their mortgages, which is an extraordinary statement because it creates a duty of care if they do.
Yeah.
So it was easier to go into the space of we didn't advise, so we didn't have a duty of care. So there are other impacts.
There's a whole range of matters arising out of this.
Financial advisor Pádraig Casán with Mary Wilson on Wednesday's Drive Time. The word inspiring can be bandied about so much so that it becomes bland and even a little twee. But it felt apt when Ryan Tuberty spoke to Anthony O'Flynn, a teacher in St Joseph's Boys National School in Terenure. And here, Anthony spoke about his own teaching philosophy.
I say to them, all the boys here, if I don't learn as much as you did by the end of the year, it's time to pack the bag. Because literally, I'm sitting in front of guys, as I say to them, Ryan, I say, listen, guys, WBEA sat in the classroom one time and someone missed him because apparently he was in the lower half, apparently, when he was in high school, and he was told to book up on the spellings of all things.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to be the guy who misses a Nobel Prize winner. Steven Spielberg was dyslexic. You know, Ernest Hemingway. And I have a list on my desk just to my right here, Ryan, and I give it out to everybody on the 1st of September. And it's a list of all the dyslexic people in the history, famous guys who had trouble with this and who went on to become super successful. And I said, don't tell me what you can't do. We're going to go digging this year and find out what you can do. So, and you wouldn't believe what comes up. But, I mean, it's a tit-for-tat thing. But, yeah, if you get kids, Ryan, it's a job to go into.
And anyone who's got a teacher like that has just got to count themselves lucky. That was Anthony O'Flynn from St Joseph's Boys National School in Terenure talking to Ryan on Wednesday. That same day, the Oireachtas Committee on the Eighth Amendment published its final report recommending repeal of Article 40.3.3, which recognises the equal right to life of the mother and the unborn child. Sean O'Rourke spoke to the chair of that Oireachtas committee, Senator Catherine Noone, and he put it to her that repeal of the Eighth Amendment might lead to abortion being used as a means of contraception.
The argument I suspect it would be put forward is, look, is that not going to increase the pressure on girls and young women not to say no? Because I should look at you can have an abortion, you can take an abortion pill up to 12 weeks if this goes wrong, if you get pregnant.
I understand why you're saying that, Sean, and I doubt that you think that personally, but that is very disrespectful to women. Women don't have...
It makes it harder to say no, is the argument.
Well, I mean, come on. That's a ridiculous argument. I mean, women do not have abortions as contraception. They don't.
No, but men might have ideas as to how they can persuade people to have sex.
Well, men have ideas about all sorts of things. If men were able to have babies, would we be having this conversation?
Absolutely not. Who knows? Mm. You say the politicians to butt out of the debate. Is that a realistic thing? Because again, people will say,
it's
you know,
not.
Government
sure,
should
here
lead.
I am talking about it myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's not realistic, but I do think we'll do the debate a service. We'll do it a disservice if it's dominated purely by politicians. I think that the medics, the legal experts and the advocacy groups have a huge role to play here. And
Chair of the Oireachtas Committee on the Eighth Amendment, Senator Catherine Noone, with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. And that same day, three members of that committee issued a minority report recommending no change in our abortion laws, and which was critical of the work of the committee, its processes and its focus. And of course, we will have our say in the voting booth in the referendum next May. Mario Rosenstock was Ray Darcy's guest on Thursday, and Ray asked him to tell us about his earliest audio memory.
Well, I suppose being on a farm, my earliest audio memory would be of animals, farm animals. I was sort of brought up on a farm, and cows would have been an early memory, pigeons. I had bad asthma, quite chronic asthma when I was a 4 and 5 year old. And I used to just lie in bed and stare at the wall and try and concentrate on breathing. My breathing was really bad. And all I could hear outside, I'd try and concentrate on the sound of the...
Oh, and sure, it's only a mere cluck cluck here and a blow there to this.
And cows were always a big thing. We had 50 or 60 cows as well, cattle. And cows actually led to was the genesis of my impersonation of Gerry Adams.
Go on.
Yeah, so I actually do this on the Late Late Show as well. So it'd be like, how are you? The reality of the situation is... So it was the tone of a cow that I actually used to do Gerry Adams.
Ah, sure, it all leads back to the manger. That was Mario Rosenstock with Ray Darcy on Thursday. You're listening to Playback. Now, it is not often you hear the words My Little Pony on Morning Ireland, but as ever, we have Bob Geldof to thank. He has donated photos and written documents in relation to Band-Aids Do They Know It's Christmas to the National Library of Ireland. Its director, Dr. Sandra Collins, joined Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland, and he asked her just what they might expect in the goodie bag.
So this is really, really exciting. A huge archive. So it's in storage in London, and we'll be bringing it over in the new year. It's a 100 square foot storage unit, full to the brim with all the written and photographic memory of this incredible Band-Aid and Live Aid. And the sort of things that are in it include letters, all the correspondence, and this predates emails. So we're talking about handwritten letters on maybe My Little Pony writing paper. It's samples here I thought just really moved the heart. I've a letter here to Bob from Thomas, who sold some conkers outside his house in October and raised £15. And a letter from Sarah, who's age 10, and she says, I watched you all day, even till 4 o'clock in the morning. You should have had the Nobel Peace Prize. I think you're great. And if you brushed your hair, you would look quite handsome.
That's lovely. That was Dr. Sandra Collins on Morning Ireland on Wednesday. But the previous day, Ryan Tuberty spotted a way that this donation might be a win-win for Dublin City's august institutions.
I wonder, will he get the freedom of the city back while he's there? We'll trade you. That's what he should do, like top trump cards. He should say, I'll give you this box of stuff, as he pushes an afternoon tea tin full of Band-Aid tat towards them. And then they'll say, and we'll give you this crumpled certificate that had been crumpled up and thrown at them. And then they could bring the mayor in, and they get the UN involved and the Nobel Prize Committee all coming in to bring peace in our time to Dublin City Hall. How about that?
Well, sure, look, hasn't he it all sorted? That was diplomatic attaché Tuberty on Tuesday. However, on the News at One on Wednesday, Sinéad Crowley was out and about and talked to Bob Geldof and asked him if he would like the freedom of the city back.
In my statement, I said, you know, here it is in the original statement. I'd like it back if you do this, you know, but if not, so be it. So apparently it's so be it. Fine.
But are you glad of the result that she does not have the freedom of the city anymore? Are you glad that you made that?
I personally think that has restored the honour of all the people who were on it and restored the meaning of being given the freedom of the city. So, you know, I have the freedom of the city of London, I have the freedom of the city of Newcastle, I have it of cities in Australia, I have it in New Zealand, I have some in America, I have Belgium, France.
But not your hometown.
But not my hometown. But it's fine. You know, what I object to is people making up that I'm disgusted and furious. I'm not. It's completely up to them.
Not furious at all. You don't have the freedom of London, Newcastle, lots of places in Oz, New Zealand, France. It's up to you. really not bothered. That was Sir Bob Geldof on the News at One on Wednesday. All week, and really I suppose all year long, the issue of housing and homelessness has been making headlines. Yesterday, Ray Darcy spoke to Glenn Hansard and reminded him of his activism this time last year.
I remember talking to you after Apollo House and you said, I think, to paraphrase you, that you were maybe a bit naive, that you didn't know how complicated the whole homeless thing was.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and in a way, Ray, I think naivety and idealism. You know, we were accused of doe-eyed idealism. That was the term I remember, one of the ones that I liked.
Who said that?
I can't remember. Maybe it was Manix Flynn, who knows. But, you know, I reckon that it might end up standing really well to you. And, you know, like this kind of naivety might end up being something really good. Because if you knew what you were getting into, you probably wouldn't go anywhere near it. And last year was a very, very difficult time. I remember talking to you, and I remember how difficult it was for me in that moment. I was so confused, and you know, basically people's lives were at stake. And in a way, we were trying not to have it seem that people were being pawns in some kind of political, because it wasn't political for us. I just wanted, you know, idealistically to get people off the street for the Christmas and just, you know, and for the winter months. And I thought naively again that the government would sort of go, you know what, you're right, it is an empty building, why don't you stay there for the month or a couple of months, or why don't we give you till March and April when the weather starts shifting, and then let's review it. But of course it wasn't like that. I mean,
Glenn Hansard with Ray Darcy on Thursday. Yesterday, Arena devoted their programme to homelessness to chime with an issue of the literary magazine The Stinging Fly, which was devoted to different aspects of this crisis. Here is poet Colm Keegan reading How Homeless is Homeless by Toby Buckley.
And how, though I know when, I am homeless enough to ask for help or even say I am. By now, my workmates think I don't want them around. I never take lifts or invite them home. Never answer questions about my weekend plans, my family, or what I watched last night. Today, I woke up cold and hungry on someone's kitchen floor, already in my work clothes, my belt, a makeshift strap for the duvet carried under my arm, counting pennies for tea. And yet, I'm not sleeping outside. There are hallways, floors and sofas I can stay on safely. How bad should these things be before I stop saying others have worse? Worst things happen at sea.
How Homeless is Homeless by Toby Buckley, read by Colm Keegan, with Sean Rocks in a special Arena programme on homelessness yesterday evening. On Tuesday, the jury at the Haw inquest returned verdicts of unlawful killing in the case of Mrs. Haw and her three sons, who were all killed by Alan Haw. Liam Keane, the solicitor who represented Clodagh's mother, Mary Call, at the inquest, spoke to Drive Time and Mary Wilson.
Well, as you say, it was an extremely difficult process to have to go through. But I have to say that what's striking about Mary Call, that would be Clodagh's mother, and indeed her sister, Jacqueline, is that they're people of extraordinary dignity. And they certainly have reserves of fortitude that one would have to admire. It's a terrible ordeal to have to go through. But they were aware that it had to be done and that it was a process that had to be gone through. And they're just glad, I think, that it's over.
How have they been coping since that August day, the 29th of August 2016, when Mary Call arrived at her daughter's house, and as it unfolded in the hours that followed, her three grandchildren were dead, her daughter was dead, and her daughter's husband, the children's father, had killed them?
Well, one can only imagine the horror that Mary Call was faced with. Look, they've coped as well as anyone could.
I think, Liam, people would have been struck yesterday listening to Mary Call give her evidence at the inquest of arriving at the house, seeing that note pinned to the family door, telling whoever would have called at that time to call the Gardaí at that stage. But she said something. She said when she saw that note, she had a terrible feeling that something awful had happened. Do you know, was that a mother's instinct or was it something more?
Well, I think it was probably a mother's instinct, coupled with perhaps knowledge of things that her daughter would have confided in her. It would have been known to Alan Hall that Mary Call would have been calling that morning. So it would have been expected that she would have been the one to find that note. That would not have been a surprise.
He would have known she would be the first to the door when her grandchildren didn't arrive at her house.
Indeed.
Mary Wilson put this question to solicitor Liam Keane.
I suppose any of us reading the accounts, listening to radio or watching TV, we wonder why. We're all looking for answers. I suppose the family is looking for answers too. There was psychiatric evidence today that Alan Ho had a severe mental illness. Does that give the family any sort of explanation at all as to what happened here?
Not really. As I said, an inquest examines the how, where and when of the death, but not the why. And it's not the role of an inquest to stray into that territory. There was evidence from Professor Kennedy, a consultant forensic psychiatrist, who attempted as best he could to provide some level of explanation. But as he said himself, he was constrained by the fact that, of course, he never met Alan Hall. He could simply rely on medical records from the GP, records from counsellor and the suicide note, and that's really all he had. So it was an attempt by an expert to provide some degree of explanation, but he accepted himself that it couldn't be complete because he didn't have access to the person concerned. Mm. In truth, I don't think anything can explain how a father would do that to his wife and children.
Liam Keane, the solicitor who represented Clodagh Hall's mother, Mary Call, at the tragic and deeply distressing Hall inquest, as heard on Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Tuesday. On Monday, Liveline returned to the love story of Matt Murphy and his carer and friend, Michael O'Sullivan, two men who were getting married to celebrate and formalise their long friendship, and to avoid paying inheritance tax. Michael explains how they met.
We both worked in Aircom years ago, and I met Matt in work, and he lived in the same area as me, Stony Batter. So we kind of just kept in touch, and shortly after my first daughter was born, and I then separated, and I kept in touch with Matt. And then when I got married again, we just didn't see each other as much. And then when the second relationship ended, we kind of just bumped into each other again, you know, and we just kept in touch then. And that's how we just kept in touch. And then he used to come out. I mean, he's just some good company. Mm-hmm. He really is a fantastic man. I used to bring him out to all the get-togethers, like, you know, we had parties, and everyone loves when Matt came along. You know, he loves chatting to everybody and talking to everybody. And, you know, the mark of a man is not how rich or how clever or how skillful or how lovely or beautiful you are. It's how you treat other people. And Matt treats other people with just great aplomb. And one thing that happened to me earlier on the second meeting when we got together, I brought him into Boyers. A lot of elderly people used to go to Boyers for their lunch.
North Dale Boyers Street, yeah.
Yeah, and as he was looking up the stairs, there was a young girl polishing the banisters. They had brass banisters, and they were polishing them. And Matt went over and said, "Hello, how are you? You're doing a great job there." And the girl turned around and recognised him. "How are you, Jimmy? That's great to see you." And a chat took place between the two, and he might have given her a small bar of chocolate.
Right.
Excuse me, I get upset when I think of it. Yeah. But this shows the mark of a man. Everyone else in that shop, unfortunately, would have ignored that girl. But he made her day by simply saying hello to her. And he does that all the time. Okay. So anyone who knows Matt knows that he's just the most wonderful man. You couldn't help but love him.
Michael O'Sullivan on his soon-to-be husband, Matt. And then Matt explained how this proposal came about.
I mean, it was a crazy notion to my head, but it was a sensible thing to do. And as I say, I suddenly, Michael's standing in the middle of the floor, I said, "I have an idea." I thought he'd, you know, pass out. I said, "Will you marry me?" He said, "I will." "Oh, thank God," I said. Then we had all sorts of arrangements. Michael's friend, who's an actor, is in the position to do marriages.
Okay.
But he rang today to say that it could be illegal, and that the people he's involved with would have to go to court, and they couldn't afford that. So then he said we should just get married if that's possible in a registry office. But now Michael's been reading all the things. There's no law against it.
Matt Murphy with Joe Duffy on Liveline, showing us that friendship can be one of the purest demonstrations of love. And Matt finished up his chat with Joe by sharing a little of how he chooses to see the world and people.
I love people, and there is good in every one of us. It's when people show their kindness, and it takes a lot. Now, the kindness to that poor man in hospital today, I was almost in tears. They showed their kindness. They cared. They really cared. And if you don't care about other people, I don't think it's nice.
Well, that's been ironic.
Try to feel, empathise. I want that on my headstone, empathy. Empathise, try to empathise with the other person when things are going wrong.
Okay. So
to me, it's the most important. It always was, because my granny brought me up very strict. And she said, do to others as you wish them do to you.
Pure and simple. That was Matt Murphy on Liveline on Monday. Now,
why is Rudolph's nose so red?
Well, we will answer that question on playback after this break. And that was the sound of Rudolph trotting. Of course it is. Yeah. You calling me a liar at Christmas? You're listening to playback and it's getting very Christmassy now. Before the break, Alana from Ms. Dempsey's first class at the Divine Word National School in Rathfarnham in Dublin asked this question.
Why is Rudolph's nose so red?
Luckily, Dr. Shane Bergen, a physicist at UCD, joined Sean O'Rourke yesterday and offered this explanation, and it is all to do with speed.
If Santa's moving that fast, the light that his sleigh is giving off is starting to bend, and that's due to something called the Doppler effect. Now, the guards use that to figure out how fast people are going down the motorway, but we could also see strange effects from Santa's sleigh. So because the light from Rudolph's nose at the very tip of the sleigh is going to be bending and bending in colour, as it moves away from us, it'll appear much, much redder. Yeah. But interestingly, if Rudolph was coming right at you, his nose would be bright blue.
Blue, you tell me. That was Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. If you're thinking of taking a bit of a dip on Christmas Day to demonstrate your chest-beating bravado and earn that hot whiskey, it's not cold, it's invigorating, liars one and all, you might want to take a moment to think of Lewis Pugh, who is a British endurance swimmer, UN patron of the oceans, and one of the world's leading speakers about the changes occurring in the Arctic and Antarctic regions due to global warming. And where he swims, well, it's not quite a dip in Bantry Bay.
How cold has it been in the water you swim in?
So the coldest I've ever swum in was down in Antarctica, where the water temperature was -1.7. Oh. So salt water freezes below zero. So the water was -1.7. But the air temperature was -37.
No.
And I remember just before the swim, a wave hitting up against the side of my boat.
Yeah.
And the water coming up and actually freezing mid-air, hitting us as slush. And you can imagine what I'm thinking. All I'm thinking is, well, not only am I in that water swimming in -1.7, but when I take my hand out, when I take a stroke, it's going to be into -37. You've got to have a reason to be swimming down there.
That'll put hairs on your chest. That was Lewis Pugh with Ryan Tuberty on Thursday. Now, they're covering themselves in the glitter and the baubles over in the newsroom. And on yesterday's Morning Ireland, reporter Aisling Kenny visited Harold Primary School in Glasthoole in Dublin, where senior infants give their views on the nativity.
Mary was in his womb, and then an angel comes and tells her about baby Jesus, and then they get together and have a baby. Three wise men follow this star, and it leads them to Bethlehem, but this king is really nasty and tries to kill the baby. The end, they all have the baby, and they all have a little party because of the baby.
Ah, now that was a pupil from Harold Primary School in Glasthoole in Dublin talking to Aisling Kenny on Morning Ireland yesterday. On Tuesday, Fiona Looney, Stephanie Preisner and Jane Hegarty came into studio with their look back of the year. And here was a highlight of sorts for Shane Hegarty.
it was just hard to get away from the fact that Ireland is sitting in between two countries that seem to be having nervous breakdowns. So I was completely absorbed and fascinated by America and Britain, and then kind of recently fascinated by how the British have kind of remembered that we're here, that the North is here, and that it was really interesting watching British television and British news recently going, oh, Northern Ireland, is that still what? We kind of thought that was all sorted out without, they'd no idea, I think, up until a few weeks ago, of the mess that they sort of created for themselves in terms of Brexit. So that's really, it's been very hard in a lot of ways to escape those two stories, and especially how Brexit has impacted on us and Europe and everything going on. And the, honestly, the madness of the countries either side of us.
But this, and it doesn't take a sort of political analyst to say that they didn't think it through.
They did not.
They didn't think it through.
I don't think they ever thought it was going to happen.
They didn't think it through. Well, ain't that the truth, sir? That was Ray Darcy and Shane Hegarty on Tuesday. Now, Fiona Looney talked about how, a one-time devotee, she has since fallen out of love with Twitter.
I doubt if it was ever the intention of Mr. Twitter, but I think limiting the number of characters to 140, and I know it's longer now, the unfortunate result of that was it meant every opinion had to be emphatic. You know, no one has ever said, on the other hand,
you can't get nuances into 140 characters.
So everything became, you know, emphatic and entrenched and more and more extreme. And not just, and I know this sounds very lazy and predictable, I kind of expected that maybe on the right wing, but I thought my lovely left wing liberal woolly headed people we'd just be still hugging each other. And to discover that the left wing are just as capable of sharpening the pitchforks and getting ready and going out with the mob, that's been a huge disappointment this year. I only look at it on days when I'm writing columns, so that's kind of twice a week, and I don't miss it, I have to say. Don't miss the noise.
Oh, and I think noise and chatter is something we could all do with less of. That was Fiona Looney with Ray Darcy on Tuesday. But at least the panel could agree on this. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído
para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito. Song of the year.
Did we all pick it?
I
apologised for it. I didn't.
You did pick it, didn't you?
I did pick it, but I didn't apologise for it.
I remember at some stage seeing something online about how this song was like huge in South America. It was really big and it had become a terrorist chant at football matches in South America. And I was going, I've never heard this song. And I think literally a month later I was going, would somebody please turn that song off? It's everywhere.
The lyrics of it are really risque, though. I speak Spanish and I heard it. Like, I went on a lovely holiday with my mom and it was playing in the radio all the time. And like, the translation of the lyrics are like, you know what, I want to like put my mouth on your whatever dangerous places. It's just outrageous.
I thought for a moment you were going to say the lyrics where I went on a lovely holiday with my mum.
Irish dancing reel. Yeah. But I think what was really funny about it is Justin Bieber covering it, which is like this blatant attempt at jumping on a bandwagon very, very quickly, and he won't ever sing it live because he doesn't know the lyrics.
Yes.
Because he can't sing it.
Still no Macarena, but that's a whole other argument.
There'll only ever be one Macarena. Shane Hegarty, Stephanie Preisner and Fiona Looney with Ray Darcy on Tuesday. Now, news never stops. And as late as yesterday, the crew on Morning Ireland were chasing the man of the moment. Would he take the call? They'd left messages, they'd texted. We know that he's busy, but...
Now, with the time at, let me see, where are we at? We're at 9:03. We're still waiting to see if our request to the North Pole... has gone in. I'm hearing a phone there. It's not my phone.
It's not mine. I turned mine off. No, it's actually, I haven't got
okay.
one. Somebody calling.
Okay.
Let's see. Better answer it.
Let's see who's there. Hello? Hello?
Hello, boys and girls. How are we today?
Santi, is that you? Hello, Santi?
Hello?
Is that Santi?
Oh, yes. Santi here with you from the North Pole.
My goodness. Thank you very much for taking your call this morning.
No problem. I love to talk to you boys and girls in RTE. I'm just checking down the list here, by the way. I'm not 100% certain you're on the nice list.
Tell us, what are you doing today?
Well, we're making the last-minute preparations to get everything loaded onto the sleigh. Mind you, it's a big job this year. There's extra toys and goodies that have to be put on the sleigh. I'm thinking maybe, although it mightn't look very good, do you think, would a trailer behind the sleigh look a bit silly?
Not at all, if you need extra if you need extra room for presents. How many presents are you expecting to deliver this Christmas?
Oh, my goodness me, I can't put an accurate figure on it at the moment. I mean, if you saw the pile of boxes, goodness gracious me, I've been trying to put these things together for weeks. But, you know, at my age now, if it weren't for the elves, they do most of the work, I have to say.
Santi,
not talk too loudly. There's talk of a minor industrial dispute going on up here.
Well, that's Ingrid Miley's Christmas sorted. But Gavin Jennings took a punt on this.
We don't have very much time left, so I'm not sure how you're going to give me a short answer to this one. But how do you do it? How do you manage to deliver so many presents in one night?
You're absolutely correct. I'm not going to give you a short answer to this. So, how much time do we have?
Oh, well, as long as you can explain to us, please. Ryan Tubridy's at Dublin Airport, so I'm sure he won't mind waiting.
Don't kid a kidder, Santa. We'll crash tubs if needs be to get this story.
I'll tell you what. I might just give you the secret to it next year.
Oh. And will you do it on Morning Ireland?
Oh, would you like the exclusive?
Please.
Ah, now. Okay. I'll have to give them. Let me see now. Where did I put out the blueprints for me? I have to get all the plans.
Oh, that's the sound of Santa stalling for time. But he is allowed. He is Santa, after all. But he did say this.
I tell you what, I've been thinking about it between now and this time next year, and I'll give you all the details then.
Santi, thank you so much for speaking to us.
And I wish you all a very happy and Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you as well. Bye-bye. God bless you all.
Thank you, Santa. That was Santa Claus, as heard on yesterday's Morning Ireland. Well, Ryan did get to air, because it's not all about you, Santa. Well, it kind of is, to be honest with you. But anyway, Ryan Tubridy was at Terminal 2 of Dublin Airport welcoming people home. And this encounter started off with a bit of the old plomos, but then someone grabbed the mic.
We were home last year for 3 months, and every Friday night we were sitting in to watch you. You were my date every Friday.
I love beautiful. Date night with you.
Rode off the red-nosed reindeer.
She's just not going to stop.
Had a very shiny nose.
She wants to be in show business.
And if you ever saw him,
yeah,
you would even say it glows.
Oh, everybody's into it.
All of the
background music, please.
Reindeer.
Look at you starting in Terminal 2. What? She's in. She's in.
Then what? She better make it.
Zebra Hamper.
Santa came to say.
Oh, this is cute.
Rudolph, will you know so bright? Will you guide my sleigh tonight? Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer.
Irish session.
Had a very shiny nose. All of
she better get paid for this.
Tease him and said, oh yeah, oh.
Yeah, she did it.
Hey, what a great singer. She didn't expect that. We brought her away from her family over to the band. A star is born.
I think I might have lost a tooth. That kid was so sweet. That was Ryan Tubridy's show yesterday out at Dublin Airport. Now we are almost ready to have a mince pie here on Playback. Richard Curran is ready to crack the whip on the business sleigh, so stay with us. But have a lovely Christmas and have a little bit of an old shimmy in the kitchen to this.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad, próspero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad.